Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Lovely to see you all this spring morning. Yesterday I managed to wander down to a discussion with the Archbishop. That was at Melbourne Edge at the Mall, and was talking about the election. And we had Judith Troth, Liberal Senator, ex-Seventh Senator, and the redoubtable Barry Jones. Will that man ever shut up? So, interesting morning yesterday morning. Two in a row. It's getting a bit wearing. We've got a great panel here for you today. I'll introduce them one by one as they come. The first speaker is Tom Pakusa, and I guess you all know from dealing with Greens about Greens List. You can do the barrister search and you'll find something on the barrister search. You can then do a Greens List search and you'll find something on Greens List for each of the barristers. But I printed out Tom's stuff, and this man knows a lot about building and building stuff. He has an expertise in a wide range of stuff, but planning disputes, building disputes, enforcements and prosecutions. If you're interested in knowing a little bit more about him, it's all there, pages and pages of it. But I thought you might be interested in this sort of stuff. Throughout 2009, advising the Building Commission and the Victorian Bushfires Royal Commission, advising Building Commission and councils on prosecutions under the Building Act. Same old regular appearances down at VCAT. But you know then what he's doing. And you sort of think, why? In addition to a Bachelor of Laws, completed a Master's degree in Environmental Law and 4 years of an Architecture degree. So that's the sort of topic that we're looking at here today. Tom's going to talk to us about building quality and defects and dealing with those sort of quality issues, particularly with reference to off-the-plan sales. Tom Pakusa.
Thanks, Mitch. Well, welcome. Thank you for coming. But my experiences in building construction, I do a lot of property work and planning and environmental work. So without wishing to talk too much about the property issues, because my colleague's going to do that later on this morning, I just wanted to share with you and introduce this topic of what do you do about building defects, which are somewhat different to defects on title. And the way off-the-plan contracts seem to deal with that issue, having regard to legislation like the Domestic Building Contracts Act and a number of decisions of the Tribunal and the Supreme Court about people trying to avoid settling on contracts purportedly for building defect issues. So the areas where people have been seeking to avoid settling on contracts relate to sometimes very specific building defects which have been identified prior to settlement. But the other area where the disputes have arisen have been in relation to the overall design of a building. And so there's two ends of the spectrum. The one case that comes to mind in this area is one from 2006 called Shaw and Yaranova, where Mr. Shaw, who was a very difficult engineer as a purchaser, said that there was a defect in the design of his windows in that they didn't comply using some technical criteria with what the Building Code of Australia required, and on that basis he refused to settle. The underlying issue was that he was one of these unfortunate people who had bought his apartment down in Docklands at the start of the boom in the early 2000s, and by 2006 he was having a great deal of trouble getting finance. And it may well be the case that over the next few years a lot of other purchasers are going to be suffering from that same issue. Now, ultimately the case was decided against him, but actually the legislation has been changed in the Domestic Building Contracts Act to make it pretty clear, that a sale of land contract is not a domestic building contract, although in some cases that may actually not in fact entirely be the case, but in large part that is what the issue is. Now, despite all of that, I do want to just run you through what building defects can be, because they encompass both works that have been done by a builder that don't comply with what the relevant standard is in the Building Code of Australia and the Building Act, or works that are done, you know, like tiles that are cracked, services don't work properly, you know, the exhaust fan in the bathroom doesn't operate in the way it's meant to, and so the whole place just stinks the whole time, because you're getting backdraft in from the central core of the building or something like that. So they're defects. The other area is where the contract says, look, bench tops in the kitchen are meant to be some exotic Carrara marble, and instead you've used Laminex. And that's not what the contract says. That's also an issue that's often disputed down at VCAT in the domestic building area. So even though in a lot of senses the Domestic Building Contracts Act doesn't apply, one thing it does have is a very good definition of what a building defect is, and it encompasses those two issues. One of things where it doesn't work, and one is that's not what I thought I was buying. So a failure to maintain a standard or quality of building work specified in a building contract, and or a breach of an implied warranty set out in the Domestic Building Contracts Act. And, you know, I've listed off in summary point form the kinds of issues that can constitute a building defect. Work must be carried out in a proper and workmanlike manner, so don't break my tiles when you lay them. Must be in accordance with the plans and specifications. I wanted Carrara marble, I didn't want Laminex. Must be good and suitable for the intended purpose. So, for example, you don't want windows that leak when you get a high wind outside and a bit of rain. You need to have different types of windows frames that cost probably quite a bit more to stop that happening, particularly important in a high-rise building. Work must be carried out in accordance with the requirements of the Building Act. Reasonable care and skill must be complete by the date for completion, suitable for occupation, and then in some particular cases, the work undertaken and material used must be fit for purpose. And what that last point is talking about is a circumstance where, look, I've got some particular requirements that I want to be satisfied. For example, you know, somebody wants to have a sound studio in the backyard of their property or within their units, shall we say, because we're talking about off-the-plan sales. That needs to have certain sound-deadening characteristics in the walls to ensure I get a nice, quiet environment inside. And if that's written into the contract, and it doesn't satisfy those requirements because you can hear the jackhammering going on outside or road noise, then that's what that last dot point is all about. So, well, now how does that all relate to off-the-sale contracts? Well, the thing is that most contracts that I've seen usually include some provisions about the application of the Domestic Building Contracts Act, just to make sure and confirm various provisions that are now in the Act about its application of the planned sale contracts. In general, the special condition will state something along the lines of that the Domestic Building Act doesn't apply. If the tribunal finds otherwise, the contract is varied to comply with the Act. Purchaser can't claim compensation in those circumstances, and any variation to the contract isn't a defect on title. Now, the key thing to remember about Domestic Building Contracts Act is that the principle that Mr. Shaw raised in his case was that because of this defect and because of the fact that I believe that this off-the-sale contract is in fact a building contract or a domestic building contract, I'm not obliged to settle until the defect is fixed. That's sort of a fairly standard requirement in a building contract. You don't obviously pay the builder his final amount of money until he's given you what the contract says he was going to. And that's obviously quite different to the requirements for settling under an off-the-plan sale contract. The Act says, and it's a funny little provision that was added at about the time Mr. Shaw was bringing his case back in 2006, to part of the definitions, or at the end of the definitions of Domestic Building Contracts Act, which says, The Domestic Building Contracts Act will usually not apply where the home is being constructed under a separate building contract or where the sale, a contract of sale so states this to be the case. So that's why there's always a provision in the contract about that application. Now, you've all seen off the plan sale contracts, and they're huge. The actual contract itself is quite minuscule, but it's usually all the attachments that take up a whole lot of volume. One of the other conditions you'll usually find in an off the sale contract is one about finishes, fixtures and fittings, which is obviously an area where there's the potential for there to be a lot of defects. And by defects, I'm talking about actual things that don't work, things which haven't been built properly, as well as things that don't appear to be anything like what the finisher's schedule say. And I mean, to some extent, if you're taking the vendor's perspective on this or the developer's perspective, it may be some years between the time when a contract is signed and delivery of the project can occur. I mean, it can be longer than that sometimes. And usually there's no building permit obtained that might require changes. Sometimes the architect hasn't thought through how all the services are going to work in a building. Or in a case I was involved in recently, which was a planning case, the developer changed. The new developer didn't like what the old one had obtained a permit for and went back and got a new planning permit that substantially changed the look, the common property areas, the design of the apartments. It was virtually a new proposal. What that developer needed to do as part of getting his planning approval was go back to each of his 180 purchasers and renegotiate the contracts with them to acknowledge the fact that some of them were losing their car parks, some of them were going to have slightly smaller apartments, common property areas were all changing. That's a quite different end of the perspective, end of the spectrum, I should say, to what Mr. Shaw was arguing about, which was my windows don't comply with the Building Code of Australia, therefore I'm not going to settle. But it is interesting that these kinds of things can and do happen quite frequently, particularly in the current market that we're in. One of the aspects about that proposal that changed was that the overall configuration of apartments changed in that proposal. So in 180 apartments, it went from largely two-bedroom ones to largely one-bedroom ones. And I don't know how they worked out what they did with all the purchasers who signed up for a two-bedroom apartment to say, oh, sorry, you're only going to get a one-bedroom one. But apparently that was all sorted out. So, but that's clearly an issue where, you know, if you had signed a contract and there you were heading towards settlement and you show up to have a look at your apartment before you settle and you find, there seems to be a bedroom missing here. I think you probably have reasonable grounds to not settle in those circumstances. Now, just before I get on to that point, there will usually be annexures in the contract setting out building and sometimes planning and sometimes building permits. So from a purchaser's perspective, you want to look pretty closely at those, but also acknowledge that the planning permit can and does routinely change. And that could well be as a result of issues that the developer is having with the council over the plan of subdivision, or that they just have a bit of a change in heart or the market, because market conditions change. There may well be approved architectural plans included there. Those plans, though, you should remember, are indicative type plans. They're not full construction plans. So they just give an indication of the overall sort of dimensions, possibly, or the layout of a development, but sometimes they're pretty rudimentary. Certainly the types of plans that might be there would only be ones that you would need to get a planning permit for. And based on those plans, you could never build a building. There's a lot of detail that's just missing from them. The other thing you find in the annexures are specifications which set out the finishes, fixtures and fittings. And sometimes I've seen them and they're just half a page where they say like the walls will be painted white. You'll get stainless steel or equivalent, fixtures, fittings in the kitchen, and pretty much that's it. You get a choice of tiles to put on the balcony floor. But in other cases, they're very comprehensive. And certainly you want, as a purchaser, to be in the latter situation, because you then have something reasonably concrete that you can look at when you go to do a final inspection of the property prior to settling. The problem that you face, though, as a purchaser, is that there's routinely a provision in the contract which says something along these lines. It's usual for the purchaser to acknowledge that the vendor or builder, in their discretion, can make substitutions, omit or remove fixtures and fittings, change the size or location of common property, or make any change to a unit to satisfy a relevant authority, which kind of makes it a fair bit harder to have a bit of a dispute at the end. And it really is an issue that you need to, if you're advising a purchaser, if they haven't already come to you and signed the contract, that you really can't be sure at the end of the day just exactly what you're going to get. And when you're spending upwards of $500,000 or $1 million on an apartment, you would probably want a bit more certainty than that if you're a purchaser as to what you might get at the end of the day. Now, just going back to the Domestic Building Contracts Act for a sec, one of the things that a purchaser off the plan in a multi-storey apartment doesn't have, which a purchaser would have, say, buying a residential property out in the suburbs, is domestic warranty insurance. And even though people argue about the value of that warranty insurance, it nonetheless provides security for a purchaser for 6.5 years from practical completion of a project for defects in the works, up to $200,000 worth of defects, but only in circumstances where the builder has either died, disappeared, or become insolvent. And practically what that means, I suppose, out in the burbs, if you're purchasing a new house, is that for all intents and purposes, that insurance has no value. But and I do know that the number of domestic building cases that involve an insurer has dropped by about 98% since that change was introduced about 10 years ago. It is nonetheless a benefit that potentially may be of some use to a purchaser, which is not available for off-the-plan purchasers.
2 minutes, Tom.
Okay. So obviously you would want to do an inspection prior to settlement. There's often a pretty restrictive process set out for that to occur. The vendor might say, look, I'm going to be settling a whole lot of properties all at the same time. The building will be open between certain hours when we notify you. There might be restrictions on how many people can go and inspect the property, but you'd probably want to get a building consultant in to have a look. And obviously what the building consultant or you will be doing in those circumstances is comparing what schedules were in the contract with what's actually there at the end of the day. Usually there's a process where you can notify the vendor of any defects by way of a list, but you're still obliged to settle in those circumstances, because those defects won't be rectified prior to settlement. It'll be usually in the defects liability period in the building contract between the developer and the builder, which is usually within the next 6 months after settlement or something like that. So, just quickly, the point of all this is to say that Mr. Shaw, if another Mr. Shaw comes to you and says, look, there's some issue with the windows or something like that, I don't want to settle on that basis, well, you can be pretty much guaranteed that he'll get a notice of rescission from the vendor. If you don't comply with that notice of rescission, well, you're going to lose your deposit. And then subsequently, when the vendor ultimately sells the unit, you'll probably be the subject of a claim for loss of value of the contract. the contract Mr. Shaw signed, for example, was for $750 and the developer sells it for $600. The developer might come after you for the $150 that they've lost on the sale, plus all their costs. Now, the only reason I raise all of that is that if some question of defect or defect on title arises prior to settlement, there's some fairly significant issues that have to be dealt with if you're acting for the purchaser. Fair bit easier if you're acting for a vendor in those circumstances because of the way that the contracts are stated and what we have to do. Now, I'm being told I have to finish, so I'd better just wrap up by saying, what do the plans and specifications say? What right does the vendor have to change the fixtures, finishes and fittings? To what extent were variations required by responsible authorities after the contract of sale was executed? And what's the nature of the defects? Are they minor or material? Those are the key things to keep in mind. Thanks very much.
Let me talk a little bit about James while he heads up. Same procedure with him. I had a quick look just because this is the sort of research I should do, but I like the comment in his material. One of the three consultant authors of CCH's Victorian Conveyancing Law and Practice with Justice Croft of the Supreme Court. So he's keeping good company. Talk about recent opinion advice, structural aspects and revenue implications for, and I have trouble with the dollars. I think it's a $100 million transaction involved in a range of things. There's a whole list of the cases he's been in. They range from caveat cases to injunction cases. But he's clearly well across the property law area. James Mackay.
Thanks very much, Mitch. Good morning. I have two topics to discuss with you this morning. The first is a general discussion of the rule in Flight and Booth, as it's known. And the second topic involves a recent decision of the Victorian Court of Appeal in Harifan Proprietary Limited and Sherman, which was decided this year. So that second case relates to the 18-month rule in terms of registration of plans of subdivision and the point at which a purchaser can rescind when the plan has not been registered after delays. And there's been some interesting new law in that regard. But before I go into that, I'll tackle briefly the rule of Flight and Booth. The reason why I've chosen to speak upon this topic is that it's just something that comes up almost on a daily basis in my practice in off-the-plan sales. The most common issue that arises that relates to the rule in Flight and Booth is where the size of the apartment on an off-the-plan development as built differs from the manner in which it's described in the documents annexed to the contract. And size is the most common issue. I mean, you'll have circumstances arising every day almost where somebody is receiving an apartment from the developer that differs very substantially from what they thought they were buying and what was set out in the contract documents. The reason why it's important as well to go into in some detail, I think, the rule in Flight and Booth is that it forms part of a broader body of law that's somewhat complicated at times, and the various causes of action or bases upon which a claim can be based tend to overlap and to obscure each other in terms of how they should be pleaded and argued and the various strengths and weaknesses of those various arguments. With that in mind, I'll just give a brief description of how the rule actually works or what its elements are. It refers to the case of Flight and Booth, which was a decision dating back to 1834 from England. So it's something that it's surprising the relevance that it has in the modern era, given it's such an old case. It's something that, as I said, is applied virtually on a daily basis. There's hundreds of references in most citators or databases that you can see where in the last decade it's been applied by Supreme Courts and courts of high authority throughout Australia. It's based on a discrepancy between a description in the contract documents and what is delivered or what the vendor seeks to deliver upon settlement. So that description is misleadingly simple, if you like, because what it's not based on, for example, is extra contractual representation. So if there's a brochure given during the sale process, for example, that says that the internal area of the apartment is going to be 50 square metres and then it turns out to only be 40 square metres, then the rule in Flight and Booth will not be attracted purely by those circumstances because the brochure is not a contractual document. the essence of the rule, to repeat that fundamental point, is that it's a difference between what is to be delivered at sale and what is described in the contract itself. In terms of size, the ramifications are obvious. Most contracts will have town planning drawings in off-the-plan sales that are annexed to the contract, and there'll be a special condition that says something along the lines of the builder is obliged to enter into a domestic building contract to procure the construction of an apartment that substantially accords with the apartment that's shown in the town planning drawings. Unlike a plan of subdivision, the town planning drawings will have dimensions usually. It'll have an actual area specification for both the internal part of the apartment and any balcony or courtyard. And that then gives you quite a solid basis to come in at the end if there is some kind of change in size, or if the apartment is very small, for your purchaser to measure it up and then give or get a precise measurement for how big the thing actually is that's to be delivered upon settlement. And then you can compare and contrast that with what's in the contract documents and make your case under Flight and Booth if there's a discrepancy. Now, the advantages of the rule in Flight and Booth, and these go also to really illustrate the scope and nature of the rule and to help you contrast it from other similar rules. First of all, there's an overlap with Section 9AC of the Sale of Land Act. That's the topic that Bill's going to be addressing you on in due course. We all know that that's based on changes of the plan of subdivision itself. And in that circumstance, the vendor has to give notice of the change, and then there can be rights of rescission that arise in certain circumstances. Flight and Booth is not limited to the plan of subdivision, so if there's it could be in certain circumstances the plan stays the same, but the actual size of the place will change because the developer perhaps diminishes the size of the apartment but keeps the overall scale the same, so that the plan, which contains no dimensions, appears to be unaltered. But of course, the apartment as built is smaller than what's measured out in the town planning drawings. Bearing in mind they're two distinct things, the plan of subdivision, of course, defines what is sold at settlement. It defines the actual title boundary, whereas the town planning drawings are usually something that sort of defines the actual structure and size of the building itself. So in that regard, just to complete that point, it goes outside the plan of subdivision. It can really confound an argument on any other part of the contract, most commonly in this context, the town planning drawings. Second advantage is there's no time limits applicable to a Flight and Booth argument. As long as you make the argument before settlement, then you don't have to run the argument, for example, before the plan is registered or within 14 days of some notice being given to you. So in that way, it sort of outflanks and exceeds the rights that you have under 9AC as well. In terms of the procedure that's applicable in getting a Flight and Booth case to court, what I often find is if you want to run, for example, a misrepresentation or misleading and deceptive conduct argument, it's very time consuming. You've got to issue a writ or, you know, a statement of claim and go through the normal litigation process that involves discovery and lengthy delays. Whereas with Flight and Booth, because it's such a legally based argument that has no real factual dispute to it, you can file an application under Section 49 of the Property Law Act and bring the case on by originating motion without having to really waste time litigating in the normal fashion. I've had cases where the issue has arisen maybe a week before settlement and I'm asked to do something about it, so I file an application under the Property Law Act. There's no need to file an appearance or anything. You can just, under Rule 45 or Order 45, Rule 6, you can go directly to the practice court and get final orders on the first return date. The reason for that is that there's no real factual dispute because it's simply an issue of law. Usually you'll have the town planning drawings that set out how big the apartment is or how big it was supposed to have been. You'll have a survey or something that's categorical that says it is, in fact, is only X dimension, so some smaller dimension. You'll have that exhibited to your affidavit and you can just go into court and say, well, there's no possible defence. It's sort of a similar thing to summary judgment where you just base it only on legal arguments and affidavits rather than some kind of complex trial that involves issues of fact. Also, in terms of advantages, there's no need to prove reliance, subjective reliance, in the same way that you would if you run a misleading and deceptive conduct argument. That's often a difficult hurdle to overcome. Also, with statutory misleading and deceptive conduct, to get the remedy of rescission, you've got to prove loss and damage as a precursor to getting rescission, which is quite, I think, anomalous and sometimes quite annoying when trying to plead these causes of action and run the cases. So you might just have a case where you're not really wanting to get valuation evidence to show that the reduction in size is going to cost your client money. You just want to get out of the contract and say that the mere size discrepancy itself should be enough to rescind. But if you plead under misleading and deceptive, you have to prove that loss and damage as a precursor to getting rescission, even if you don't want to sue for damages. So that's an annoying element of misleading claims that you can avoid by using this rule in Flight and Booth. The last advantage, as I'll come to, is that it's very difficult to exclude this rule using ouster clauses or waivers or special conditions that purport to override the rule so as to force the purchaser to accept something that's different from what's specified in the condition in the town planning drawings. I'll come to that in a moment. The limits of the rule are, first of all, as I said earlier, it's a rule based on a difference between what's in the contract or the contract documents and the thing that's the vendor wants to deliver at settlement, in this case an off-the-plan apartment. Therefore, ex-contractual representations such as oral statements from an agent or brochures that are given during the sale process, none of those things can found a claim in Flight and Booth. Second of all, is that it's not really a claim that will lead to damages, strictly speaking. There might be a sort of modern way to run a Flight and Booth case where you seek rescission and then seek loss of bargain damages as well, but in my experience, Flight and Booth is something that's designed to achieve rescission as the remedy and not damages. The third weakness is really related to one of the strengths. I said before that it's very difficult to contract out of Flight and Booth, if you like, but also the extent to which you can or cannot contract out of this cause of action is something that's very difficult and has not been settled in a clear way by the courts. So when you run an argument based on Flight and Booth, you're going to be met with the usual special conditions that all developers have in the contract that purport to override your right to get something that accords with the documents and tell you that you're going to basically cop whatever the developer wants to give you at settlement. And there's a real question as to how far the developer can go in that regard, and I'll come to that in a moment. The last weakness is Flight and Booth is based on substantial discrepancy between that which is to be delivered at settlement and that which is described in the contract documents. Bill will tell you in a moment about Section 9AC and how low the bar, if you like, has been set recently by the case law in that cause of action. You only have to show a sort of material effect or alteration, which is a low bar, whereas in Flight and Booth, you've got to show a substantial departure or a substantial difference or discrepancy.
2 minutes for Harrowfan.
Yep. Harrowfan was a recent decision of the Court of Appeal, as I said, dealt with Section 9AC and 9AE2 of the Sale of Land Act. Section 9AE2 of the Sale of Land Act, which reads as follows. If the plan of subdivision is not registered within 18 months after the date of the prescribed contract of sale of a lot on that plan of subdivision, or if the contract specifies another period before the end of that specified period, the purchaser may, at any time after the expiration of that period but before the plan is so registered, rescind the contract. So we're all familiar with that. It's the rule that talks about, or really sets a deadline for the developer to get the plan registered, and it provides for the purchaser to pull out of the contract if that registration has not occurred within 18 months or some other deadline that's been set in the contract. Clifford was a case from 2010 where the Court of Appeal knocked out a clause that purported to give the vendor a unilateral right to extend that deadline based on the vendor's opinion about whether it was going to be delayed in procuring registration of the plan. So essentially had this contract that could go on ad infinitum at the vendor's discretion if it was delayed for some reason in getting that registration. The court in that case held that when the Section 9AE of the Sale of Land Act talks about specifying another period other than 18 months, whether it can specify something that's open-ended like that, that can flux according to the vendor's discretion or according to certain delays that are not known at the time of purchase. And the court in that case held that it could not, and there must be a definite time that's set. In Harapham, there was an attempt, if you like, to outflank Clifford on the basis that the vendor had included a clause that allowed for extensions but put a cap on the extension so that instead of there being this open-ended right to just extend if there was any delay or any chance of a delay, the right of extension was capped at 6 months. And the vendor, of course, argued that that's different from Clifford because there was that certainty that was given to it by the 6 month cap on the time limit extension. The Court of Appeal rejected that and said that what the legislation actually requires is some kind of specific time frame. So you'd have to have, for example, a date by which the plan must be registered, a literal like 12th of September 2013 date, or some kind of measurement of time from the date the contract is entered into. So, for example, 24 months from the date of sale. No longer can you have anything that can flux or lead to any uncertainty about when the date in question will fall. So it's really ended. The effect of it is you can no longer have any kind of uncertainty in these planned registration extension clauses. You must nominate a date by which the plan must be registered, and you must revert back to the 18-month default position. You cannot have something that can extend according to some uncertain time frame. Thank you.
Thanks, James.